and welcome back to the Palace Way podcast. It's been a while for that. We apologize. But it's time to talk about what must be one of our best performances of the season so far, even if it sadly wasn't rewarded with a victory. I'm joined by the wonderful Pat, who is our co-host. How you doing, Pat?
Doing well, doing well. An unusual cold night in Tampa, which is laughably still 55 degrees Fahrenheit. You do like, what, 15 degrees, something like that. About 15 degrees over there. And that's, I'm wearing a sweatshirt and a jacket because this is like the blizzard season for us Tampa people. You know, sadly, we just don't have the toughness of weather anymore.
Yeesh. Yeah, I swear Tampa's always getting the most insane weather. I think I can't go a week without hearing about something mental going on over there. But yeah, a good point against Newcastle at Selhurst Park. I was in the stands. I screamed in the most embarrassing way when that Munoz header went in last minute. And I will say the mood in the stands was very negative. You know, we had seasoned supporters leaving 10 minutes early. It was starting to empty out. I considered leaving actually a little bit early. I hate to do that. I haven't done it since losing 4-0 to Sunderland on that first game that I went to. But my friend who I was with, who was a neutral going to his first Palace game, said, "Now let's stay." And his faith was rewarded in what was quite an amazing goal. What were your thoughts when that finally went in, Pat?
At first, I just felt relief for Munoz. You know, he missed, you know, well, he had the one miss in the first, and then he had the one off the line by Byrne, I believe. So he had those two big chances, and neither of them went in the back of the net. So for him to get the equalizer, I felt that for him. You know, I was really happy to see him kind of get that vindication and salvage a point.
Yeah. I mean, God knows it was deserved. I'm sure you'll have the XG values up, but we basically pummeled them. They had a single shot, not on target. And we were very much the better side throughout pretty much the whole game, apart from a spell in the second half after we took off Will Hughes. I think we struggled until we got the momentum back when they sort of sat back. A couple of things I haven't seen people talking about is Mark Gay was... And this is both a pro and a con for the way that we're sort of looking to play. But Mark Gahey was one of our chief creators in the game. You know, mm-hmm. He played that really good ball over the top to Ismaila Sarr that Pope just about saved, resulting in the Munoz follow-up that was cleared off the line expertly by Dan Byrne. Gahey's header set up Mateta for that chance from the corner that he scooped over from about 4 yards out. And of course, Gahey put out that excellent cross for the last minute Munoz header. Now, obviously, Gay is an unbelievably sort of technically gifted footballer. We've seen him pull out crosses before. I remember him pulling one off with his weak foot against Everton away last season. We shouldn't have to rely on a centre-back, but I'd argue this was just a case of that being what was needed to break the deadlock. And, you know, in the void left by Joachim Andersen having sold him, to have Mark Gahey step up in the meantime, at least until he leaves, is really positive to see.
Yeah, and it wasn't just him creating in the final third, it was him progressing the ball from into the final third or into the middle of the pitch. He was one of the most progressive carrying players on the pitch. He pushed the ball forward more than I think anyone on our team other than Lerma. And I think the Lerma being back is a huge reason for that too, because Lerma has that ability to go back into the back three and play as a center back. He's done it before. So they kind of were feeding off each other. He knew when to step back and Gabe would go forward. Just really good to have Lerma back overall. It definitely helps our entire defensive outlook on the game. But in general, our back three has just been so solid, and that's one thing we don't talk about enough. And Gay, he's obviously part of that, so if we're not talking about that enough, we're not talking about him enough. But they just, in open play, they allowed 0.02 XG. Like, if you want to be all statty about it, that literally just means they didn't have any chances. They had no chances at all. And if you want to argue, like, the caveat with it is the own goal, if that hit someone on Newcastle's foot, that's probably 0.5 XG. But even so, we still battered them, in creating chances and getting into advantageous positions on the pitch, and playing the ball where we kind of wanted to. Against Villa and Fulham, we had seven combined tackles from midfield, from the middle third and the attacking third combined. We had 20 against Newcastle.
11 of which were Daniel Munoz.
Yeah, it was just phenomenal. We played aggressively, and I think the midfield really helps that. When back when you look at the Fulham match and the Villa match, you had Doucouré coming back, but he still wasn't really where he was supposed to be. You had some substitutions, some younger kids playing. It definitely, you weren't able to play as aggressive because you didn't have those like stalwarts in the midfield to kind of protect against that. So having Lerma back and Hughes knowing what to do in that role and just huge.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lerma was someone I was really feeling the influence of in the ground. He just makes us so much tidier. And his long balls actually out wide were something we've been missing a lot, I think. You know, that's something Wharton and Hughes and Devenny, don't do as well, the sort of lofted balls to the far wings, because we don't want our wing backs having to carry the ball really. We want them to pick it up in the final third and have an opportunity to create. That's why in the games where Munoz and Mitchell have struggled the most, it's been the games where they've been sort of required to beat a man. You want the pass to kind of do that job for them. And Lerma was sort of being very successful at making passes that gave them that opportunity. You spoke about the strength of our back three. I think obviously Maxence Lacroix has been an absolute revelation. He is so good. Just physically, technically, he's adapting to the Premier League. He's had moments where he's made mistakes and he's not been up to pace, but he's getting into it. Without wanting to sort of zoom into something negative, I think the person that's convinced me the least is Trevor Chalobah, who made quite a few errors during the Newcastle game. He did that during the Wolves game as well and was responsible for a couple of goals there. He was re responsible via poor clearance for the goal we conceded that made us lose at Nottingham Forest. I'd say he's probably been the most shaky and culpable for errors since coming in. So I'm here to ask the question, does his lack of maybe consistency warrant opportunities for the returning Chaddy Riyad and Chris Richards from injury, do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. If we can good cop, bad cop this one, because I do agree with what you're saying, but I think the good thing that he's doing is that he is very good in terms of positional awareness. Like his problem is never usually he's out of position. It's just some individual error, like where he rushes forward to try and win a ball and loses it. He's not really beat on a counters very often, so it allows Munoz to get up because he can play in that wide area. So that's the good part about him. It's not that he looks lost out there, that he's kind of not knowing what he's doing. It's just that, so yeah, sometimes he's just a step slow physically or just makes the wrong split
Yeah.
second. So I don't know. I would love to see what Riyad's got because he has a really awesome, I mean, I watched him at Betis a lot and he's pretty great. He's young, but he can pass the ball in any direction at any pace. It's with any power. It's fantastic to watch. So I'd like to see how he adjusts into, the Premier League. But I think Chalobah is a good place for him until he at least can kind of get to pace, get to health, and get to fitness and adjusted. He only had what, one match until he got hurt, two matches. So.
He had one start against West Ham and then he got injured in the cup after starting that as well.
5 minutes, yeah. So. I mean, I think Chalobah hasn't done a terrible enough job for me to let him get pulled for someone with it without experience, if that makes sense. But he's good. Richards is another one that could come back and play. I think he's better at that left side of role, but
Yeah.
he's still good. He's still good for depth. So
But
we
I
have
don't know
the
if we might need someone in that left-sided role given the
January.
think of how our team could change in January. You know, Sammy Mockbell's come out and put out an article, as we often see in January, that Palace don't have many funds available. If we do want to move for an attacking midfielder, which we do, and a left back, which we do, then a sale for Mark Gahey before his contract runs a little bit too low might be the move.
Trying to play chess a little bit there, huh?
Yeah. So yeah, Chalobah's obviously a developing situation. We'll see how he grows, but I've seen, Bobby talking last time we spoke about Chalobah's fitness maybe being an issue. It feels like we might be past that point now, and he's still not really growing into it, but I'm hoping it's just a case of adapting to a system still. Like, sometimes it just clicks for a player, and we are starting to click as a team. Eze and Nketiah both back from injury. Eze, typical for him post-injury, right? It's sort of not really influential throughout the game, and given that he doesn't have other players around him, it's just moments of being better than other players technically, but otherwise pretty inconsequential. Anything you'd add to that?
No, I think Eze is more of a put a ball on a platter for another person to tap in or create that assist than he is someone to just come through and be that killer instinct himself and bury a goal. Not that he can't, but I think when he works alongside somebody that's more of a finisher, that's when he's at his best and that's when we're at our best. And Sar's getting there. I am impressed with how he plays. I like his physicality. I like his directness, but he's still lacking that killer instinct in the final ball. So as they did what he could, he tries to step up too much and take the game over a little bit at times. He did that a little bit in this one too, but overall, I think he's doing well. He just needs one of his teammates to become a little bit more clinical and start to finish the balls he's laying on for him.
And obviously, Eddie Nketiah was brought on as a sub for Will Hughes, at which point we kind of lost control of the midfield. And I'd argue that's when Newcastle started to ease back into it. Ease might be the wrong word, but Nketiah wasn't particularly impressive after Mateta wasn't, great as a sole nine. Nketiah yet again asked to play at left, sort of attacking mid. So it was not really seeing him in position. Is it just a case of him, being recently injured and being asked to play a role he's unfamiliar with, or is there something kind of more latent in him that's preventing him from thriving at Palace?
A little of both, maybe. It definitely isn't fair. Glasner seems to, and Nketiah is a very interesting case, man. Like, Glasner seems to believe that he can play in this kind of, right-sided or left-sided 10 role where he's underneath a striker, but he doesn't look good whenever he plays in that position. He looks better when he's up top, but he hasn't really gotten form in minutes because, we have Mateta there, so. It's just odd to me if he was actually brought in to play that role, or if they're just trying to shoehorn it because they really wanted the player, so he's trying to fit a way to play him because, it's odd to me. And yeah, he doesn't look like he looks like a striker playing in an attacking mid position or a winger position. I mean, even the better strikers would look a little awkward playing in those roles, So it's not fair to him that he hasn't done much, but yeah, he hasn't done much, and the few chances he has had, he's not been able to capitalize on too, so he's kind of hurting himself in that regard.
He's just a strange profile of striker for a team playing both our system and at our kind of level. If you look to similar clubs, players like Dom Solanke at Bournemouth last season, or Liam Delap at Ipswich, Taiwo Awoniyi, or Chris Wood even at Nottingham Forest. You could argue Muniz, Fulham, bigger players, kind of Mateta, more like players, are the strikers that tend to thrive. So Nketiah is a strange signing. Obviously, he does, I guess, bring versatility, even if he's not particularly great out wide. And he is a ball carrier, which is di a different kind of profile for a striker. He's able to drop in. Not that you necessarily want that, but he's capable of it. I think an underrated quality of signing is his friendship with Eberechi Eze, which kind of doesn't get spoken about that much. But the club know what they're doing in signing a footballer for maybe a little bit of a premium as to what he's worth otherwise, if it means we get to keep on to Eze for another season or two. And I think that could be a sort of underlying fact there. Look, one more sort of topic about the Newcastle game before we go to a quick break and then answering listener questions. It is, the month of Justin Deveney, I think. We got to see him in three games, being his debut against Fulham, where he was one of our best players despite the poor overall performance. Got to see him at Villa, where of course he scored, and then he came on at Newcastle and was generally quite good. Look, everyone loves to see a player come out of the academy. Is he an academy product? He's a player that was bought to play in our academy, has improved in that system and is now graduated to being a Premier League player and an international player. So there's at least some degree of credit to Palace in addition to, you know, what belongs to Justin. But yeah, it's been really exciting seeing him kind of break in. It's the first time we've seen a Palace Academy player score since Tyrique Mitchell. But yeah, what have been your thoughts on him so far?
There's, and I know I'm the one always touting, look at objective stuff and all that, but there's a certain intangible kind of when you get on the pitch when it's your, debut or you're young, if the moment looks too big for you, if you get wide-eyed, if it doesn't look natural, or if you just come on and just go out there and play and let the game come to you. And he's definitely the latter in that regard. The moment didn't look too big for him. He didn't look out of place, which is a big compliment in my opinion that you give if for a new player. Just it didn't look different with him out there, and yeah, he continued to improve, got that goal, which was incredible, and stepped in and really kind of solidified the midfield against Newcastle to keep it 1-0 for us to be in the chance for that equalizer at the end. So yeah, it's been a joy to watch, and I think there's going to be more for him to come.
Yeah, I think he offers something different to the current profile of players we have, which is actually really exciting. In that he's obviously left-footed, which Wharton and Hughes are, but Tavernier's kind of a different player in how he plays passes. You know, Wharton likes kind of more central balls or sort of bounced plays out wide. Hughes is a lot more of a sort of shorter range, straight pass kind of guy. Tavernier loves a progressive pass kind of out wide to the wing backs. That's kind of his trademark pass. He's much more confident in the attacking penalty area. He's a true box to box player when he's given the liberty to play that role. And we saw that with his counter-attacking run that resulted in his goal at Villa. And he made that same run a few times against Newcastle. He is also a really good set piece taker. His corner delivery, I think he took two this weekend, was pretty much impeccable. We had big chances from both of those corners. And he had a free kick, obviously, at Fulham against Fulham that was, you know, a really good free kick taken and a chance that we wasted. He scored multiple free kicks at international level and at academy level as well in the last year. So that's something that he provides that we're missing now, at least from a left footer in the absence of Michael Olise. So that's something to look forward to. But no, he's sort of generally a lot more tenacious than our existing midfielders. You know, Doucouré, Hughes, and Wharton in particular can be maybe a little bit slow and a little bit restrained in sort of getting involved in things. I know that's a weird thing to say about Will Hughes given his sort of aggression, but Tavernier can just stretch that little foot more, and it kind of changes both the feeling of the team and the feeling of the crowd. Like standing in the stadium when he made that tackle on whatever winger he was up against after being brought on, it felt like a turning point for us. And after that tackle, you know, he pushed up the pitch, and I think he actually played the pass to Mark Gahey, resulting in the cross for Munoz. So yeah, you know, Devaney's done himself very proud in the club as well.
Yeah, I think him in those kind of more forward 10 roles behind the striker. I really like him up there as well. He just, like you said, he has a confidence, a directness to his play that really benefits those attacking positions. He's pressing and counter pressing exceptionally well. He has, a ton of work right there. So I like him in that kind of front trident a little bit too. If that's not his best position, then he's going to be a joy to watch if he's playing that well out of position.
Perfect, thank you. We will be right back after this quick break. This episode of the Palace Way podcast is sponsored by Crystal Palace official partner, ComAV. Follow ComAV on all social media channels and check out their website for chances to win exclusive gifts and prizes for Crystal Palace fans. All right, so I think it's time for some of the listener questions that you guys have sent in via Twitter and Blue Sky. Little shout out there, by the way, the Palace Way is now on Blue Sky, so you can follow us on there. The first question comes from Palace Memory, who says, Is there anything affecting Daichi Kamada's poor form beyond simply not adjusting to the Premier League?
Yeah, it goes back to kind of what I'm th saying about Nketiah. The same idea, Glasner tends to do this to people. He's just getting played out of position, and I know he was brought in with the in mind to kind of cover both spots, but it's just not working at him in that deeper role. He doesn't have the instincts, like the positional awareness. To me, it's not like a physical thing. I think he goes for tackles. I think he's just a step slow because he's positionally just not aware in that area, but he can offer a lot in the attack. I think he hasn't played up there enough for us to give a fair evaluation. I don't need to go too far on with this because we beat it like a drum, but I just wish he would play up there for a run of matches, a couple substitutions in the same position, and just then we can judge. But yeah, I think it's just a tougher league, a more physical league, and then he's just not playing in the position that's his best.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is definitely a case of not seeing him in his best position, which we can say is probably a left-sided 10 in this current system. Now that, Eze's back, we probably won't see him start in that role. Hopefully, Eze doesn't get injured, of course, but he's got one more game, which is against Ipswich, where he will be absent due to suspension, but after that he'll be back. We'll probably kick Caleb Cupora out of the match day squad, but he is, at the end of the day, a technically gifted footballer. He hasn't really been on the same wavelength as the rest of the team. He's tried little passes that just haven't paid off because Mateta is a little bit slow to click it. I kind of think Daichi Kamada would play best if he was played with Eze and Nketiah. I think that's probably a front three we might see in the cup at some point, whether that's FA Cup or Carabao. So, I think we get to see the best out of him, but there is a player in there. He had the same poor start at Lazio. It took a managerial change there for him to kind of really kick on. Glasner knows how to use him. It might just be a case of the players we have at the moment. But with more than half the season to go, there's plenty of time for him to adjust to the league and be utilized better. The next question, do you agree we ideally need a left-footed, right-sided number 10? And if so, who would be some of your choices?
Okay, so I looked this up because I'm a psychopath, and so 11 seasons as a manager for Oliver Glasner with five different clubs. When he's had a back three, that's his formation, as his tactical setup. Here's the full list of first choice left-footed, right-sided number 10s or right wingers, whatever you want to call it. The full list is Michael Olise. And that's it. That's the list. There was his first season when he was his first season as manager at SV Reed. There was a left footer that played in that role for about 10 matches. Other than that, he's never had a left footer in that role. So it's not, we don't need it. He played Olise there, and Olise showed what a quality left footer can do in that system. So, it's not, I'm not against it, put it that way, but we absolutely don't need it. He won Europa League with two right-footed players. He finished, high in the Bundesliga with two right-footed players. So not needed, but if we want one for balance, then we absolutely could benefit from one.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate here and kind of push back against you on this. Is it possible that that's maybe just circumstantial differences? We've seen that this Palace squad benefits from a left-footed, right-sided 10, and maybe in the past it's just been a case of those players work together with that system. In terms of left-footers, when we have players on the pitch like De Veni, Hughes, or Wharton, we just instantly gain a lot more range of passing, right? And creative options, because you don't have to open up your body to play it to the right. When we've got all right-footed players, we kind of get pushed slowly leftwards, and that means ending up with a Tyrick Mitchell attacking chance, which tends not to go optimally. Like, he isn't the best attacker. We recognize this. We shouldn't want the ball to kind of get to him at that stage. Ideally, we want players who can either, put in a cross for Mateta, or a through ball to Mateta, and take players away from Eberechi. So we definitely need someone who's quick. Ismaila Sarr obviously has that. We need someone who's a good dribbler. Ismaila Sarr does not have that. And we need someone who is a creator. Are there any players in sort of an affordable price range that you think meet those criteria?
I have one, and it's a left footer also. It just happens to be a left footer. I kind of looked for a left footer for this scenario, and I think he fits well. But the question asked for what left footer would I suggest? Andreas Skov-Olsen at Club Bruges. So he's a 24-year-old Danish player. Like I said before, I was kind of setting up for this. I think Eze's better at playing the final ball for someone else than actually shooting. And playing a player like Skov-Olsen across from him, I think would open both of them up. It would open our club up. He's one of the highest in terms of goals minus XG, which is a metric to look at basically how clinical are you or how good are you at making shots that maybe you shouldn't be making, just looking at clinician. One of the highest in the Belgian league right now. And sometimes that can be a false lead because it could just be a fluky thing. But for the past 5 seasons, he's outperformed his XG by a considerable amount, like in the top 95 or higher percentile for his league. So he's a proven finisher. He finishes more than he should. Having him in our system, I think, would be huge. Absolutely huge, because now we have a threat from goals, just like we had from Elise, that we really don't have right now. So that would be my left-footed choice, or just my overall choice. I think he's a brilliant player, Danish international as well.
Yeah, that's a good pick, actually. I was thinking sort of Eden Jagrova from Lille.
Also,
I love the way he plays. He's in really good form. He'll probably end up going somewhere higher. And in the same league, obviously, there's Rayhan Cherki, who we've been linked to quite a bit. I think he's maybe operating at a level above us. He's got attitude problems. He's also not left-footed. He's just very, very two-footed. And he doesn't hit the criteria of being quick, although he is an unbelievable dribbler. So, these players do kind of exist, and I think within our budget, I do have faith we'll pick the right one. Normally, our January business in the reign of Dougie Friedman has been pretty exceptional, and I've got no doubts that we'll capitalize on the funds that we kept over the summer. The next question comes from Lewis Jacks. Let's do this one just really quickly because it's a similar kind of topic. Which position should we be prioritizing in January, and who should we be looking at? I guess we've covered the right attacking mid role, so I guess it's left back that's been spoken about the most.
I said, I had wing back depth in just general. And I think depth would be, I don't think we need a person that is going to come in and take starting minutes right away. I think we could, get one left wing back, one right wing back, maybe a younger age that we could just give consistent minutes to. We don't seem to have one in the academy that we're confident in. So maybe we could go elsewhere for just trying to blood someone in.
There are a
That would
couple, actually, though, I will say, like Caleb Cupora as a right back, right as a wing back kind of
Be
depth.
more pro, I'd be more for that. Yeah, I'd be more for bringing him up from the academy for sure. But in any way we could do it, I think that's where we need help.
Yeah, I'd guess the reason we haven't bought a right sided player is because of Caleb Cupora, because he's getting to a level where he's, ready to deputize. And we have Nathaniel Clyne there as well. On the left side, it's a little more complicated. We haven't had a good left back at 21's level now for a while. We released Vonte Williams in the summer, who had a really long injury layoff before that. Teo Ademola is obviously out on loan. Freddie Cohen was, hit or miss on whether or not he'd even be given a professional contract, and he's currently out injured. Dean Benamah in the under 18s is quite the player. We've got an article coming out on him later this week. So watch out for him, but he's just too young and not ready to even be in the consideration. So yeah, I think probably a left back is someone we need to sign. It's obviously Glasner's priority. I know we've been scouting a couple more rogue options. There were talks of Kostic and Gosens, who are, senior players, international players. In the summer, but we've been scouting far and wide, the Belgians, the Switzerlands. So expect some rogue names in January. The final question, as we're running out of time, is from Lockster, who asks sort of generally about the potential new buyers for John Tex's shares, which are obviously up for sale, and our thoughts on the current situation and fresh ownership. I can start that one off. At the moment, it's looking like the UAE and America Sports Bank consortium is Steve Parish's favorite. That is headed by two self-declared fans, funded by money coming out of Abu Dhabi and America as well. From a sort of ethical, moral standpoint, we've got an article coming out on that one as well very soon. So stay tuned for that, and I won't go into too much depth on it. But on a base level, you can't own two clubs in the same league, and the UAE investment fund already owns Manchester City. So there isn't going to be a direct governmental link to the UAE. That just isn't going to happen. However, there is, of course, the question of, in the UAE, how unconnected to the government can a very big company be? And that'll be, something that has more light shed on it in the coming months. The other party is interested is Stanley Tang, who was one of the founders of DoorDash. He's kind of looking less likely now. He'd be an interesting option. He's not previously invested in much sports. He's a very successful gambler. He plays quite a lot of sort of games like poker, so on and so forth. And he would kind of fit that kind of model of people that get in through betting, the Tony Blooms. So that's a remote possibility, although looking less likely. And obviously, then there's the possibility that Harrison Blitzer buy out John Texter as well. I mean, honestly, I think that would probably be my preferred option, weirdly enough, just because they're a known quantity, they're on board with Parrish's vision, and they have shit tons of money. I think sometimes it's easy to forget how much money they have because it doesn't feel like they're that involved with the club, but they would be if they own that much. And I'm always quite hesitant about taking money from the Middle East, but it remains to be seen. I'll sort of wrap up just by saying, the current situation is stupidly complex. I think Matt Wisdom of The Athletic recently called it the most complicated ownership structure in the Premier League. There are too many at the moment. John Texter needs to go because he's just disrupting the whole vision. That's just the way it's worked out. Steve Parish is a fan and owns a 10%, and that's it. That is a good thing for where the club is at the moment. He gets a lot of hate, but at the end of the day, he's the one person you can always trust to have your best interests at heart. Can that change in the future with two new fans potentially heading the consortium that buys out Texter? All I'll say is I did a bit of Twitter research, and one of the people that claims to be a fan referred to Liverpool as we multiple times. So, as recently as a year ago. So, never trust
Too
Liverpool themselves, a fan or a lifelong fan or whatever, because it's all about the fucking money. And there's no morals at that level of wealth for the most part.
No, and I agree. And it's the old adage of the devil you know is better than the one you don't. Harris is doing having a lot of success with the Commanders over here in the NFL, so he's showing that he does decently in these situations as making owner decisions. So if they do buy out, I mean, they haven't done much for us in lately, but like you said, maybe with a little more say and a little more equity, they feel more need to protect their investment, so to speak. So yeah, just getting less heads in there, less chefs in the kitchen. I agree with all that. I think that's the best way forward.
Yeah, hopefully we just come out reasonably unscathed and hopefully a lot more wealthier at the end of it. All right, I think that's about all we have time for today. Thank you very much for just coming on again, Pat. It's been a brutal slog, and we've given ourselves a bit of a break, but it's good to be back into it. Obviously, we'd be very, very, very grateful if you could leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to check out our website in the coming days, the aforementioned articles that will be coming soon. But with that basically all said, thank you all for listening. Let's hope Palace can get an excellent result against the Traktor Boys tomorrow.